the ban on LGBT people serving in our military until the year 2000 was an appalling failure of the British state, decades behind the law of this land. As today's report makes clear, in that period, many endured the most horrific sexual abuse and violence, homophobic bullying and harassment, all while bravely serving this country. Today, on behalf of the British state, I apologise. And I hope all those affected will be able to feel proud parts of the veteran community that has done so much to keep our country safe.
Yeah. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak apologising on behalf of the British state following the Etherton Review in July 2023 to personnel affected by the Armed Forces homosexuality ban that was lifted in January 2000. Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Welcome to this edition of General Talk, in which, during LGBT History Month, we mark the 25th anniversary of the lifting of the ban on gay people serving in the armed forces. A defining moment to recall its significance, remember the trials and ordeals endured by many, and reflect on the considerable changes to the military working environment. As you will hear in this programme, some veterans who experience discrimination and dishonourable discharge find themselves in need even today. And the Army Benevolent Fund wants to make it clear it is here for all soldiers and veterans. To discuss this milestone anniversary, the progress made since the ban was lifted, and to look ahead to the future, I'm joined by Ed Hall, former officer in the Royal Navy, Chair of Trustees for Fighting with Pride, and author of We Can't Even March Straight. Brigadier Claire Phillips, CBE, Deputy Military Secretary, Chair of the Army LGBT Plus Network, and Guardsman Wes Gurren, serving with the 1st Battalion of the Irish Guards. Brigadier Claire Phillips joined the Army in 1995, 5 years before the LGBT Plus ban was lifted. I asked her what life was like as a cadet at Sandhurst and young officer 30 years ago.
Life was very different. So I reflect on that time as a really interesting period of army life, that there was still so much secrecy and privacy around sexual orientation, gender identity. There were so many assumptions made about who people were in their private lives and the need to really live two separate lives. And I always reflect on the Monday morning conversations where my colleagues would be talking about where they were, who they were with, in a sense of openness. And I would always have to say I had a great weekend with some people. And that sense of almost betrayal, that I was betraying those people who I'd signed on the dotted line to say I would fight and die alongside, but yet I wasn't able to share my whole authentic self with them, felt like a level of duplicity that could undermine the very essence of the Army's fighting spirit. So a fascinating period, difficult in so many ways. And it's such a relief, I think, when I think back to those times and then to reflect on where the Army is today, where we celebrate all of our people for all that they bring and want to embrace the diversity of thought that the Army today therefore enables.
Am I right in thinking that you had to have a picture of a fake boyfriend in your bed space?
I did have one, and the fact that I felt I had to, everybody else did. I imagine not of a fake boyfriend, but everybody else had pictures of their important people. It felt like a really good way of a distraction technique. And a way of deflecting the conversations and the questions that I was concerned could come my way. And that in itself, you know, it was a lie. And an institution, the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, where integrity is everything. And so to live that level of duplicity was, I think, awkward to say the least.
Ed, you, a member of Rank Outsiders, you founded the Armed Forces Legal Challenge in 1994. Tell us about the campaign, the challenges you faced, and how David overcame Goliath.
Yeah, it really was, wasn't it? You know, the more I look back, with the 25th anniversary, we've been sort of pulling out bits of history, and I'm looking at pictures of me. I look like I was still at school, in my 20s, sitting in front of an Amstrad word processor, which Wesley, who's joining us, probably doesn't even know what it is, you know, but all the lettering was green. All the pictures were green. There were no colours on the screen. You know, we're going back to that era. And, you know, what had happened was that a group had been formed, as you said, Rank Outsiders. And that was formed by Robert Ely and Elaine Chambers. And they'd both lost their careers, one as an army nurse, one as an army bandmaster. I mean, what world do you sack musicians for being gay? But anyway, that's what was happening at that time. And they'd come together and formed this group and given evidence at an Armed Forces Select Committee. And that had started at the beginnings of a movement. And most people at that point, if they attended Pride at all and they were serving, did so very, very discreetly. You know, it was a case of wearing hats and, you know, wrapping your face up because everyone was terrified they'd be identified. And people were sacked for attending Pride marches. So, you know, they were almost very nervous. And suddenly Rank Outsiders appeared and had a banner. And they were marching at London Pride, and I think 93, and I saw that, and like many others, sort of gravitated towards it because we were in a very strange world there. I mean, Claire's, you know, very eloquently described what it was like to be serving during the time of the ban, but of course to be in the armed forces in the lesbian and gay world of the early 1990s, 80s and 90s was also a bit of a challenge because it was fundamentally of the left and of a radical movement and all strength to it for that. But it meant, for example, that if you attended, meetings with Stonewall, you would be in the room with people who were Greenham Common campaigners. Now, you know, doing that and saying you thought that, you know, lesbians and gay men ought to be able to support our continuous at sea nuclear deterrent didn't immediately have a warm welcome. So there was this tension between these two groups. And gradually that came together. And it was out of that that I thought it was time that we fought the ban, and Rank Outsiders has set itself up very much to provide support to people during the process of being sacked. And what changed in 94 was a sort of ludicrous, as it seemed then, ambition to challenge the government on the very principle of the ban itself.
Let's move forward to the lifting of the ban. What was your reaction, Claire, when you heard the news that the ban had been lifted in January 2000?
That's a really good question, Harry. It wasn't any immediate change. I think two things can be true at once. The law, the policies can have changed, but the attitudes might not have. And so there had to be a journey, an incremental journey of education, acceptance, progress, steps forward, steps backwards. I think if I were to describe it through my own experience, it felt like a really gradual opening up of freedom, that I measured every conversation I had by my sense of how the person I was speaking to might react, and over time have cared much less about how people might react because it has felt as though the environment has been so much more accepting. And so gradual, slow, evolutionary progress that enabled the change in policy to become a reality through people's change in attitudes.
So gradually, as the armed forces evolved, so today we have what General Patrick Saunders referred to as the army of the talents. Wes, you joined the army, the Irish Guards, in 2019. You've marched in uniform in Gay Pride. You've presumably been on the King's Birthday Parade. How are you received in training and on joining your battalion?
First of all, just to say, really inspiring. Both, thank you both so much for all that work. Like, just hearing these stories now, I'm just like, wow, it's really inspiring for me even now today. And I will say, for us, for myself personally, I've never had any direct issues being in the army, being openly gay in any way or form, even in training, supportive. Even most of some of my actual training team had gay partners or gay siblings, etc. Anytime there was even an inkling of anything that was untoward to, against me, they were straight on it. There was nothing. I couldn't even stand up for myself. They were already in front of me, like, standing up for me. It was the complete opposite, where even now I'm so free on my own battalion. Like, I can bring my partner here, and it's just so normalized. It's very much like, yeah, and we can sit round a table together, and even when we're discussing partners, they know that my partner is male, and it is so normal to be like, oh yeah, and where's his partner, or they're mentioned by name, or it's just really wholesome now in that sense. So it definitely went in the right direction in that case. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm sure that not every battalion is exactly the same, and of course there's going to be people that don't exactly conform to the normalized behavior, but again, that's kind of the world that we live in, rather than a reflection on the military itself, that their opinions and the way they are completely backing everybody being themselves unapologetically.
Whereas your guards and your infantry, you're at the very forefront of any operations that would expect to take place. What do you say to those who think that lifting the LGBT plus ban detracts from the military's fighting spirit?
What retracts from the military fights, but I don't think that's correct in any way or form, to be honest with you. In fact, I've seen so much spirit at any of these marches, at any of the group events that we go to, or any of the support that comes from the LGBTQ plus network. And if anything, it's a family of its own, which only can add to the military's fighting spirit more than anything. I don't think it would ever take anything away.
Claire, what's your view on transgender recruitment? How is that accepted within the armed forces?
I think the bottom line is, it is accepted. It's the, you know, we are each one of us as human beings has such an important part to play to make the army the effective, motivated machine that it needs to be. It makes no difference. Somebody's sexual orientation and gender identity make no difference. And I think I would reflect on the way in which we might define ourselves. You know, LGBT plus service personnel are not defined by their sexual orientation or their gender identity. They're defined by their service to our country, and that's what matters.
And Ed, we've had the Everton review. Can you outline how that has affected or changed the look back on the last 25 years?
The Everton review has been the most extraordinary undertaking. It's been an opportunity so long in the making, but that Fighting With Pride, the charity I'm very proud to chair, was able to persuade the government that it was time to look at what was done. And I think you touched on this in one of your earlier questions. The issue is, for many, that they think this was historically a small administrative quirk, that people served knowingly against rules, and that it was inevitable that, if sad, that on occasions their careers came to an end. And what the Etherden review has done is put a lie to that sort of popular belief, because what was done in the name of the ban wasn't simple administrative discharges. And many people, remember that the army recruited under 16 years of age in the time that I was serving. And, you know, at that age, many people hadn't come out. I didn't come out until I was already in the Navy. You know, and that was true for many people in the 70s, 80s and 90s. So, as they did, you would think there would be a way of managing that. But what actually happened was that the investigative capability of the forces and the service police was used to try and track people down. there were literal lesbian investigations that spanned the globe. You know, so if a woman was suspected and arrested, her calendars, her diaries, her photographs, all of her history would be gone through forensically, you know, like a CSI episode. And then any link or relationship or mention of another person, who is this letter to? Who is this letter from? Who is this diary entry about? When did you meet them? Which regiment are they in? Where are they serving? And these investigations, you know, spanned the globe, literally from, you know, a base in Germany to a base in Colchester to a base in Hong Kong. Yeah, and service police would try and catch people out. People were fired who were celibate. So in the armed forces was more aggressive in its application of this ban than the church. You know, it was an absolute ban, and it was. And it was enforced with rigor. People were subject to horrendous medical examinations. You know, the stories that you read in the Etherton Review, and it's a stunning publication. It's available on gov.uk. I recommend anyone to read it. It's only about 180 pages. But if you're not moved to that, moved to tears by some of that, then I think you lack heart, because it shows what was actually done. And Lord Etherton, the High Court judge, who was the first gay judge, but who conducted the review, first gay High Court judge, what he's done is record for all of history what was done between 1967, when homosexuality was made legal in civilian life, until 2000, when the armed forces finally caught up. And when you read that and you read his recommendations, you realise how many people were damaged, not just LGBT people. You know, friends of mine, when I was arrested, they were arrested and carted off to be questioned about being gay. They're not gay, but nonetheless were put into, you know, interrogation rooms with two members of, you know, SIB and interrogated about having been on holiday with me and what happened and where did we sleep and how did we sleep there, and then warned not to stay in touch with me. So this ban had an insidious effect, not just on the people that lost their jobs, but on everyone around them. And that's not a healthy environment in which to live and work. So all of that is captured by the Etherton Review. And he made a series of recommendations, one of which inevitably catches the headlines, which is about some financial reparations for those people who were affected by the ban. But there's a raft of them. People have got their ranks back. People have had pensions restored. People have had the reasons that they were left, that they left the forces, corrected. You know, people are all looking forward to the unveiling of a memorial to those veterans at the National Memorial Arboretum in the autumn. And I was privileged to see the design for the memorial a few weeks ago. And it is absolutely an appropriate military memorial. It will be a very moving part of our military story. And it, you know, for young service people like Wes, who look back on, you know, the old people like me as we always do, you know, at remembrance for, you know, 100 years, you know, young serving people have looked at the old people and wondered about their stories. And it's really important, I think, that the story of LGBT plus veterans is included as part of that story. It doesn't detract from it. It adds to it. Remembrance is a complex thing. We all have different ways that we engage with remembrance. And for the LGBT plus community, having the memorial unveiled at the National Memorial Arboretum is going to be a spectacular event in the autumn.
Claire, looking back on your 30 years of service, what are your feelings on the situation today?
So if I think about where the armed forces are today in terms of their approach to inclusion, and I know that there are some words and phrases today that have become quite politicised. For me, inclusion is about allowing all of our service personnel to be the very best that they can be, to contribute to the outcomes that the army needs of us, that our country needs of us, as well as we possibly can. Inclusion is about allowing talent to thrive, leadership to flourish, and integrity to prevail. And that's the army that Wes and I represent today so incredibly proudly. The talent and the opportunity that members of the LGBT community bring to the army. The army is stronger because of our inclusion, because we bring different ways of thinking, as do so many people, and that enables the army to flourish. I find myself nervous because of some of the narrative, the global narrative at the moment. And you know, we're here today because February is LGBT History Month, and recognizing the history that we have, as Ed has so clearly described, and the horror of those times. I was reminded of a quote the other day that those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And I think in these complex times in which we are living, and I think about the individual contribution that, you know, Ed made, Elaine Chambers made, Robert Ely made, I think it's really important that we remember today that whilst this is a complex, busy world of powerful characters, every single one of us as individuals can make a difference, and we have to hold on to that and make sure that the progress that has been made is protected, and that our future is not defined by division, but by acceptance, love, and unwavering support.
As we mark the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz and the freedoms we still fight for today, it must be a matter of some sadness that the armed forces still need to keep driving the LGBT plus messaging. Ed, your dare of fighting with pride, what's your view on that and the relationship that charity has with the armed forces?
Well, the service charity sector is tremendous. You know, the work the Army Benevolent Fund and the other service charities do is incredible. And, you know, the reality is that if you served, that sector should be there to support you. Sadly, for a significant proportion of our veterans, they never felt that relationship was there. So, you know, if you were marched off your base and sent to prison in some cases, then it would be very unlikely that you would naturally feel comfortable calling the Army Benevolent Fund or the Royal British Legion or SAFA and Art Help for Heroes asking for help. And yet you are entitled to that help, and you are a veteran. And a large part of the Egerton process and of the work of Fighting with Pride has been to ensure that the veterans from my era feel that the veterans community is there for them. And I know the ABF, for example, has supported one of our veterans community workers, so that, you know, veterans, LGBT plus veterans who lost their careers, sometimes in circumstances which will stay with them forever, and that have had lifelong impacts on mental health, on housing, on work history. You know, so for those people, having a friendly and understanding face that can act as their access into the service charity and the veterans charities world is hugely important. And, you know, I'd obviously like to put on the record our thanks to the Army Benevolent Fund for the support that they've given, because there are actual people who are actually helped because of the work of the veterans community worker that you guys have funded. And so, you know, don't underestimate that. It isn't the touchy-feely agenda. It's not the stuff in the papers about, you know, trans wars or woke wars. This is actual money that has actually helped pay the salary of someone who has enabled people to sort out problems, complex problems with health, with housing, and with employment. This is real charity work on the ground, and we're incredibly grateful for it.
Wes, let's talk about you. The focus is on you because you are the future. You have a long career, hopefully, ahead of you in the army. How do you see the outlook?
I see it quite positive, if I'm honest with you, especially with the way that the army is kind of moving forward with the support and what I've seen at the moment. I feel that the family that's being grown at the moment and the level of acceptance that is being presented in front of me from what I've seen is extremely positive and heading in the right direction for sure.
Claire, how do we reach out to the LGBT plus community to recruit from them?
I think the important aspect about any kind of army recruitment is making sure that the army shows itself to be an environment where people like me can fit, whoever that version of me is. And therefore, it's about making sure that we continue to break down the stereotypes of who you need to be in the army, whether that's in every aspect, whether that's about gender or race or sexual orientation or gender identity or economic background, geography. And the army is a place for everybody. It's a place where we can all find our tribe. We can all be the best versions of ourselves, and we can grab the myriad of opportunities that the Army and the Navy and the RAF offer for people to serve their country, to explore their leadership, to travel the world, and to make a difference on a human level to our society. And so the Army is working really hard to make sure that we tell that story, and we tell it to everybody, wherever they might be, to show the truth that I know, which is the Army is for all of us.
And if you wanted to sum up the situation as you see it succinctly, what's your last, your closing comment?
Well, we all know that there's a recruitment crisis in the armed forces. That's not a secret. And if the armed forces want to be an attractive place for, you know, dynamic, young, smart people like Wes on the call, you know, to join the armed forces and to be part of defending the values that we believe we stand for, then we need to be a welcome and inclusive place. Nobody in their 17, 18, 19 year old phase of life in our country now wants to join the 1950s. You know, it would be an absurd view. You know, and you know, if you know, our generation, you know, Harry will remember the Be the Best, you know, advertising campaigns for the army. You know, well, if we want the best is the best, whether or not they're lesbian, gay or transgender, the best is the best. And, you know, we need to have an attractive place to work, a place to work that offers people the ability to be proud both of themselves and of the work that they do defending our nation. So, you know, I when I watch what's happened to women in some of the countries that we have challenges with at the moment, you know, if I talked about our enemies at the moment, I could point to places where gay men are thrown off roofs, where women are sold into sexual slavery. You know, you can understand why women and gay men and people in the communities that are part of the alphabet soup would want to fight, because they're the people who are in large part affected by some of the terrible things that are happening in the world around us.
Wesley, what's your view?
If I was going to close anything up, there's still people, even in our country at the moment, that don't realise that it's still, that it is legal to be absolutely gay and or be of a different sexual orientation in the military. We still get asked now, like, is it okay to be gay? Is it okay to be this? Like, so it's, even though that we're like, we're here, we're inside of it at the moment, we know, like, yeah, this is fine, this is normal, like, etc. It's still, it's good to be seen, it's good to be there, it's good to be at the Pride marches, it's good to be around, because it gets you seen, because like, oh, you can't, well, they're doing really well, that's fine. And it's also giving that kind of inspiration to those around you, especially you have to kind of stand on the shoulders of giants in some aspects. And it's nice to know that there's my inspiration, I can be like that guy. Because when I was there, I never saw any armed forces marching in Pride when I was there. I didn't even know that I could be in the armed forces in that respect. I always wanted to join. But it's by being present and being there that allows us to actually, you know, inspire the younger generation to go, well, this is where you could go.
Today, perhaps two thank yous. So one thank you to the ABF for everything that the ABF does to support the whole of the army community. My second thank you, and whenever I talk about the LGBT community, my thank you is always to those who went before me. And Wes, your words are absolutely perfect. We stand on the shoulders of giants. And in all of the conversations that I have, I always want to be able to say to those veterans whose voices were unheard for so long, thank you for my service. And it really matters to me that we have the opportunity to do that.
Standing on the shoulders of giants, Ed Hall, Chair of Fighting with Pride, Brigadier Claire Phillips, Deputy Military Secretary, Garvin Worthy Gurren, thank you so much for being my guest on General Talk.
And my thanks once again to Ed Hall, Brigadier Claire Phillips, and Garvin Worthy Gurren for being my guests on the programme. And to remind, The Army Benevolent Fund is here for all soldiers, for life, regardless of gender or sexual orientation. We encourage anyone in need to approach us. Contact details can be found on the charity's website, armybenevolentfund.org. You can learn more about the work of Fighting With Pride, the LGBT plus military charity, by visiting fightingwithpride.org.uk. General Talk has been covering the many facets of Army life for 5 years now, from basic training to top brass, the corridors of power, tales of yesteryear, and even reaching out into cyberspace. We've had a good run of it, and next month will be the last programme in this long-running series. We're going out with a bang. My guest for the final episode, marking Women's History Month, will be General Dame Sharon Naismith, Vice Chief of the Defence Staff. Do join us. Until then, from me, Harry Bucknell, thank you for listening and farewell. Series editors were Jane Redman and Natasha Theobald. Studio editing was by Michael Ciliano. This has been a Gamekeeper production for the Army Benevolent Fund.
Great. Folks, I think that's the wrap. Ed, thank you so much for your long discussion, your long guide of London's memorials and your saluting talents.